Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, we're joined by our friend Ben Goldsworthy again for a chat about the dehumanisation of war.
Yeah, so Ben, you're a sort of cybersecurity researcher and you're sort of interested in war and security and defence and all that kind of stuff. So we thought dehumanisation would be quite a good topic to talk about with you because obviously cyber warfare is a big issue in security at the moment, and that's perhaps the most dehumanised that war could be, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose. You've got computers flinging sort of non-existent weaponry at each other, and maybe no one's getting hurt, maybe they are.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? There's a big discussion about whether cyber warfare is even warfare, because, well, is it an act of war if you just destroy data, or does somebody actually have to get hurt? Does it have to be physical effects? Isn't it?
Mm. And, well, are not people data, in a way? Is data not a part of us?
Oh, very, well, that's very meta.
Very meta to open up the show with.
Information theory there.
Yeah, no, I'm all about that. Yeah, I'm all about that. I surprise myself sometimes.
So I suppose kind of dehumanisation is in various different... you can view it in different ways, can't you? Because removing the human from conflict.
Yep.
So a lot of people think about drones and autonomous weapons. And obviously we've mentioned cyber, but there's also kind of the more classic example of dehumanization of the enemy and thinking that they're less than human. I think you've done quite a lot of work on that, haven't you, Mike?
Yeah, so I mean, it, just in a general sense, when you go to war with any nation, you tend to see this thing where the enemy nation is seen as being unhuman. So like in Vietnam, which is sort of one of the things I look at particularly, you might see them be defined as like the Gooks or the Viet Cong. I mean, they're supposed to be seen as animals, because in a way that's made them easy to kill.
Charlie's coming out of the trees.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you go back to sort of World War II, I mean, obviously it was Jerry, wasn't it? We're going to war against Jerry. It's not a person. It's some sort of dehumanised individual that makes it easy to kill, when ultimately they are the same as us.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess that plays into the. Kind of the criticism of drone warfare that it's just a video game, that they're just pixels on a screen, and we've spoken about this before, haven't we?
Mm.
That kind of idea, it's not really doesn't really ring true when you hear kind of the testimonies of actual drone pilots and stuff, because they spend however many hours a day watching somebody, and then they have to blow them up and watch the explosion and watch the blood splatter on the walls and see what they've done. So I guess in that way it's kind of brings a human element back to dehumanised warfare.
Yeah, I mean, there's this element of distance, I think, especially with drones, because I think we were at a conference together where we were talking about precision and accuracy when it comes to bombing, I think it was, and the whole idea of war where you've gone from this place where, right, okay, I've got a knife, I stab you, I win, like, to then you've got a gun which takes me further away from you, then you've got a tank, so I'm even further away from you, then you've got a bomber and I'm in the clouds, so I can't even see you, and now you've got this point where you can actually be in another country pressing a button to then decide that I'm killing you. Like, you don't even have to be in the same country anymore as the person that you're killing, which in a sense is also a dehumanising effect, because you're distancing the deliverer of force from the sort of victim.
Yeah, I suppose it's perhaps only going to get worse. Well, the concept will only get, the distance will only get greater with autonomous weapons, because you can press the button and walk away.
Yeah.
To some degree.
Yeah.
I suppose the sort of issues that are coming up now in PTSD amongst drone pilots, despite how geographical your distance may be, when you are watching these people for however long it is, and then firing your missile and then watching the aftermath through the screen, I don't know what the term would be.
Well, John Williams calls it distant intimacy, which I think is a great phrase.
Possibly. I was thinking like temporal distance, but that's sort of time based. But
there is a temporal distance, because you have the lag as well, actually.
Yeah.
There was a time lag.
Yeah. So I suppose in the dystopian future, you'd have your drone pilots who watch the target, then just as it's time to fire the missile, the screen shuts over to some other guy who's just been sat there eating chips, and he presses the button to fire the missile, and then watches the aftermath.
Perhaps goes to somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting idea.
Or maybe you could have three people in a room, and you could all be piloting the same vehicle, but only one of you is actually the one pressing the button. You have red buttons, like with firing squads.
Yeah, everyone only gets one, a blank except one guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, that's certainly not the ideal scenario.
No, of course not.
You can see it being sold as like, oh, we're looking after our veterans' mental health. We're dividing the drone duties amongst multiple people so that you don't have to blow up the guy and his family that you've just been getting close to for the last week. But that sounds like a avoiding the real problem with why did we have to blow up that guy and his family.
Yeah. It's a, yeah. Shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic, I think, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me of the Ender's Game sort of conundrum, which I don't know if you've seen I sent you some stuff about Ender's Game before. From my own research, I write a chapter about Ender's Game and this idea that they're all they're piloting these sort of computer. They think they're playing a game where they're fighting against this sort of the aliens in this computer game. They think they're doing their training, but then at the end, after they've just won and they've destroyed an alien planet, it gets revealed to them that actually they killed real aliens, and actually the people on all those ships that you lost, they were actually people on them. They weren't just computer sprites. And so there's this whole sort of reverse of the drone idea that actually the whole thing becomes very real.
Yeah, I suppose in Ender's Game it's the reveal is more impactful because the way that Ender wins the battle is because he kind of specifically sacrifices a lot of what he thinks is his own team to win.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously it's a literary device, but it makes the point even more, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, very, very much so. I mean, that's sort of the whole part of the game. But then there's also the idea that, well, you've just committed genocide. Because here it wasn't just winning a game against an arbitrary win condition. The win condition was you must destroy this homeworld, this ending. So it's not just winning, it's destroying them completely.
Yeah.
And that was also the other thing, which then sort of follows up in other books. But I mean, that's a sort of
Xenocider in other books.
Yeah. But I mean, that becomes very interesting. And Speaker for the Dead.
I never read the first one. I know Orson Scott Card got a bit weird partway through.
A little bit, yeah. But I mean, I think you need to sort of read his other books as well to be able to then make a comment about Ender's Game. And there's a lot in the literary theory, because obviously that's my angle of things. Some people at the time did call him like a fascist and stuff. But actually, saying, well, Ender's not guilty. They accuse Orson Scott Card of saying that Ender is basically committing guiltless genocide. But the whole idea of the book, and this is where the critics go wrong, is that it is about guilt. The whole book is about guilt. He writes books about Ender's guilt. Like, Ender is guilty. And the thing is, it's not his guilt because Ender's manipulated, so it's not really even Ender's decision. He's just a kid that's being manipulated by machines all along.
Yeah.
Atis Rea and Mens Rea.
Yeah. Difficult.
Sorry, that was quite a tangent.
but talking of fiction, Ben, you mentioned before that you've got an example of dehumanised warfare from
Star Trek. Yeah, just when I saw the topic on the list you sent me, I immediately thought of one of my favourite episodes of Star Trek, so this is taking a nerdy turn.
That's good.
We're all nerds here, it's alright.
So it was original series, I forget which season of that, but with like Spock and Kirk and Bones and all the rest of it. But they get to this city and they're talking to the people and it's all like a lovely utopian peaceful place. And they keep talking about, oh no, there might be an attack soon, but the guys can't see any sort of sign of warfare, so they're like, what are you on about? And there's sirens and everything, and they brace for impact, but nothing happens. And they're like, okay, that was weird. And then they start seeing all of the people they were talking to walk off because the sort of loudspeakers are telling them to. And they go to these booths, and I think Kirk asks, what's going on? And it basically comes to pass that this planet was in a huge nuclear-powered war that was destroying their whole planet, basically. And they came up instead with, they'd simulate the war, and they'd simulate attacks on places, and if a place was attacked, the people in it were considered dead, and they had to go to these pods that would kill them. And the idea was the war could continue, but they wouldn't destroy their habitat, which just, when you said about dehumanization of war, that sort of struck me. So you've got the same, you can still claim geopolitical objectives through military means.
This is really interesting. I didn't know about this episode. So essentially, what you're saying
is Taste of Armageddon,
right? So essentially, they were just saying, "Well, okay, 100 of us are going to die."
Yeah.
So because of that, 100 of us,
we got hit by a nuke.
We'll actually die.
Let's go kill ourselves.
Right.
No, at least the buildings can survive.
This reminds me of another book that I've sort of read. It's not so well known, called Limbo. It's a bit sort of neo-Freudian in places. It's very long. I wouldn't recommend necessarily reading it. It's very long and a bit boring in places. But there's this idea that, well, to get away from war, what we're going to do is, because we have to sacrifice limbs and stuff in war, we lose stuff and we don't get to choose. What we're going to do is we're going to take control of war and we're going to choose what we lose. So we're all going to sacrifice our limbs and replace them with prosthetics as a way to sort of avoid war by making the sacrifice already before the war occurs. In a weird sort of masochistic...
It almost make war into like gambling, so you're the commander and you've got your decks and you don't have to rely on chance so much. Like,
yeah.
My small group will attack you and roll the dice. It becomes like Dungeons & Dragons or risk or something, but with actual lives on the line.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely mad, but it's kind of a satirising this idea of war and sacrifice, and so, because it makes it a completely arbitrary function where the most successful people in society are the ones with the least limbs. But then they have, what happens is the irony is that they all replace them with limbs, robot limbs that are better, exactly. Mm. And then in the end...
I'd replace my limbs in a heartbeat if I'm...
Well, yeah, but then they replace them with... they've got guns in them and stuff. So actually they're even more capable of making war. And then they do make war again, and then the Cold War returns. It's not Cold War, it becomes a hot war. But yeah, it's quite an interesting concept, though, that idea that these people are sort of sacrificing themselves in a sort of role-play game.
Yeah, sacrifice themselves so that everyone else can sort of live, but... Spoiler alert for those readers who haven't seen an episode of Star Trek from the 60s, but at the end they sort of come to pass that neither side remembers why they were fighting. They've just been so conditioned. It's like that study about chimps or something where they get hit. They'd hit them if they tried to go up some stairs, and then they get some new chimps in, and if anyone tried to go up the stairs, the other chimps would stop them, and if they tried anyway, they'd beat them up until they didn't. And you kind of forget the original, like the original thing that annoyed the chimps stopped happening, but everyone there was
conditioned to.
So yeah, there's an element of, if we have this sort of rise in cyber war, at which point does it become cost effective to make actual war less damaging through sort of managed death and destruction?
Yeah.
If you're like, okay, Russia, if you promise not to destroy all my critical national infrastructure, then if you say you've blown up this place, then I'll get rid of those people.
Mm. So you're essentially turning war into a war game in a way.
Yeah.
Because, when it comes to kind of to drone warfare as kind of an extension of state bureaucracy, Derek Gregory, one of our friends. It's not quite our friend, is he? One of our favourite political geographers refers to the administration of violence rather than the exercise of violence.
Mm.
So I suppose in that way it links to ideas of cyber warfare, in that it's a more socio-techno kind of aspect of applying force, in inverted commas, because it might not be physical force, but sort of an effect, a harmful effect, I guess.
Yeah. But in a way, I think that cyber warfare is far more harmful in a way than drone warfare, in the sense that it affects us all more individually, and it can affect us more.
It depends what happens, because if you the classic kind of cyber warfare attack is on an Iranian nuclear refinement facility.
Stuxnet,
yeah. So, because either the Americans or the Israelis, no one's quite sure who did definitively, or maybe they did it together, but wrote a cyber weapon, inverted commas, that made the centrifuges spin too fast, and so they all broke. And so they put the Iranian nuclear facility back. Nuclear program back several years, so in that way, it doesn't affect the public in a way. I suppose it does because
if you're messing around with nuclear centrifuges, that might very well have affected the public around that.
So you knock down their power, or you take down their medical records, or
in that way,
stuff like that. Take down their Wi-Fi for a week, see what happens. I reckon you'd have war on Lancaster campus if you took down the Wi-Fi for a week here. I mean, it sounds small, but trivial. But in the scheme of things, and then
Even bigger and non-trivial when WannaCry knocked out the NHS for however long that was. I haven't seen any analysis of how many deaths were attributable to that, but I find it hard to believe it was none. There must have been some people who couldn't get the organ in time, or I imagine life support machines are on their own little networks, but there certainly must have been some human cost to the WannaCry attack beyond the financial one.
Ring up the surgeon to come and do an emergency surgery, and then the person on the table doesn't make it.
Dad's having a heart attack. Oh, sorry, we haven't got the GPS working. We can't get an ambulance to you.
So in a sense, that exposes our over-reliance on technology to an extent. Because we're all so connected these
days.
But
also the human cost. It's a nice clean cyber attack.
But it's not.
There's people on the end of it.
I mean, that could have been created by a sort of kid in his bedroom. And that's the other thing with cyber warfare, where it almost democratises warfare to the extent that anyone can do it. Anyone with a sort of... This is why you see these things in the news, don't you, about these sort of autistic kids who are sort of hacking NASA and banks and all sorts.
And then later get employed as a cybersecurity expert or as a
hacker. Or extradited to foreign countries to be tried.
To trying to imply something about
me. Depends how...
I've kept my nose very clean, thank you.
Depends how dirty you've got, I guess, doesn't it? But one of the things I was thinking about when, Ben, you mentioned about gambling and in terms of war as a game and by bureaucrats was... In a way, we think of, or we think about the 2008 financial crisis as being the fault of bankers who were essentially gambling with our money and investments. And actually,
people lost houses and lives from
people
that.
Lost so much because bankers were basically felt like they're in a casino. And in that way, you know, the harm that was done essentially through a socio-technological banking system, you know, had a similar effect to what might have been a cyber attack or a cyber war, an act of cyber war. But it's kind of dehumanized to the point where actually there's not necessarily a direct human victim. It's all reverberating effects of people who don't have enough money.
But there is a victim. There's loads of victims.
We're all victims, but not direct. I mean, nobody died directly because the bank account got emptied. They died because they couldn't afford food as a result of.
Yeah, so it's sort of cause and effect. It's a cause within a cause. I mean, obviously, in a previous episode, we talked to Ben about e-voting. I think voting systems is a thing that sort of comes up, and not just voter systems, but the way people vote and the way cyber technologies can be used to influence people's opinions. Obviously, there's this whole sort of debate over whether it was influenced the American elections, whether they influenced the sort of Brexit votes. But you can think even on a sort of day-to-day level, the way sort of news media is manipulated, or the way sort of our Facebook feeds are manipulated to make us think certain things or behave in a certain way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a human cost.
Absolutely.
But in a way, people think that it's not a human cost because people don't directly die, but they do sort of get affected quite seriously.
Yeah. Austerity kills people, but it's a very sort of second or third order effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't it like a million years of life have gone from Western Europe or something because of austerity? It's a massive effect, but because it's...
There's no one, like, presses the austerity button and 400 people in Clacton-on-Sea... The speakers tell them to go into the suicide pods.
Yeah.
You don't make the sort of connection. I was thinking when you're talking about dehumanization as well, there's a quote, I think I'm going to say it's from an ancient Greek, but it could be from someone else.
Anybody in the ancient.
I remember it from the Rome Total War loading screen. But it's good that war is so terrible, else we should get used to it.
Yeah.
And it feels like when you sort of clean it a bit, there's a risk that you do get used to it. And so if we assume for a basis that war is sometimes necessary, so we'll ignore pacifism and all that for now, there is a utility in creating abstractions of war to help people make horrible decisions better. So you think of generals with their maps and their blocks of things where they might have to sacrifice 1,000 people in order to get 20,000 people round and beat the enemy. And if they had to go and tell each of those 1,000 people, okay, you're not making it back, you might... then it would never happen. So you need to have that abstraction to make it possible for a non-complete sociopathic human mind to fathom.
Which is the Ender's Game thing that we were sort of mentioning.
Yeah. But then you risk going too far that way and making it too sanitized, too clean. And suddenly it's like, oh, here's a problem. Oh, why don't we just have a war? They're quite fun.
Or even with the drone warfare, sometimes with heads of state looking at screens and not really... realising the actual human impact, because actually those people on screens are affected. I mean, not talking about drone pilots per se, but when it goes to top level, it's like, well, quick, there, we can see him, let's kill him. And then you don't then sort of stop to say, well...
Yeah, I mean, I guess the classic case of that is the photo of the Situation Room at the White House where Obama and the top political guys and and Hillary and kind of the top military people kind of watched the head cam footage of the raid in Osama bin Laden's house. You know, watched the reality of what they decided happened, and okay, at the end of the day, it was the person they wanted. But
I wonder if any of them ever watched Zero Dark 30 after that.
Probably.
It's like, oh, this is bollocks.
But I mean, I guess in that way, it's dehumanising in terms of the fact that the political leaders are, you know, they're not physically present on the operation, but the reality of what's happening is very clear to them. I suppose mentioning of political leaders, Ben, you had some ideas about. Specifically targeting political leaders through some methods of technology.
I do feel like talking about this might get me put on a list or something, but there was a paper we looked at for TTAC, Haas and Fisher, and it was about how they made some predictions of how the future of war would look like based on drones and swarm technology and stuff like that. And they were talking quite a lot about how they expected to see more sort of surgical attacks on the top figures, the top brass of whatever enemy it is, because drones sort of act like the new Kalashnikov. Anyone can get a drone, a little quadcopter, pack it full of dynamite, fly it towards, I think, was it Maduro? like a couple months ago.
Yeah, in Brazil, yeah.
Attacked by a drone. And they were sort of saying this very sort of staid and academically. And I thought, if I was being very optimistic, that sounds like quite a positive development, because before you'd have your kings and your lords who, if they could get a bunch of poor saps between them and the people who wanted to harm them, then they were pretty safe, because the people who wanted to harm them had to go through all of those poor saps. But now there's kind of a direct line to them. And you, for a weird comparison, think how customer service has improved since Twitter, where you can just message the account of whatever airline screwed you over on tickets, and they respond very quickly because they know everyone can see it, usually. It's almost like send your message, which is also coincidentally explosives, directly to the head of the enemy force that you're at.
Yeah, and I was just saying, this is interesting, because I talked about limbo before, and this whole idea of people chopping off limbs. There's another interesting satire in there, where he comes up with this concept called the assassination clause.
Oh.
And it's this idea that heads of state, essentially, there's this rule where if a head of state does something wrong or takes the country into war or whatever, they do something that's against like their manifesto, they instantly make themselves open to assassination with no from anyone. Any member of the public is allowed to, without sanction, they're allowed to assassinate.
All sounds very The Purge.
Yeah, no, I know it does. Yeah, but yeah, no, it does. But I mean, he's satirising the sort of concept that is sort of mirrored in what you're saying, because you're saying that anyone essentially is free to then go and murder a leader.
So obviously this is the most optimistic view is that the little man can now fight against the big man.
Yeah.
So to invoke Godwin's law, the little man could fly a drone at today's Hitler and stop him oppressing whatever countries, or stop her oppressing whatever countries. But the obvious flip side of that is that there are bad people out there who
can do the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the dichotomy of the democratisation of violence, isn't it?
If you let every Tom, Dick and Harry attack people, then some of those Tom, Dicks and Harrys you'll agree with, and some of them you won't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this links with the abstract, it's abstracting violence, isn't it, in a way? And we're all becoming so desensitised to violence.
It's like crowdfunding violence.
Well, yeah.
Anyone can get a drone and... Maybe you could even, somewhere on the deep, dark corners of the dark web, have... I know back in the early days of the dark web, there was assassination markets for an idea.
Yeah, they were real or rumoured. No,
yeah, people could put sort of bounties on political figures, and then if someone killed that person, they'd be able to claim the bounty from whoever chipped in.
Yeah.
And sort of an extension of that, you could have like a Kickstarter for assassinations. If everyone funds me this much, I'll go over to Country X and... fly a drone at politician Y.
Yeah. Well, it's quite interesting because I was watching Black Mirror the other week, and there's an episode there, and it's sort of linked to...
Is that the one with the bees?
Yeah, the robotised bees. So the story is that...
Hated in the nation.
Yeah. So the story is that biological bees have all died out for various reasons, so they're replaced with robotic ones, and a nefarious programmer creates a system whereby you can basically tweet... You can vote for somebody to die on Twitter, and then whoever's number one gets killed by one of these bees, but then eventually it turns on them, and whoever's voted, which is thousands of people, they all get killed by the bees. So it's
dystopian futures. Yeah. But I mean, this is stuff we've got to think about, really, because this is possible.
Yeah, I mean, I guess...
Maybe not the robot bees.
So maybe not the robot bees. But certainly in terms of like the idea of voting for somebody to die, because... somebody has a drone and everyone can vote on it because it's the internet, and it's no matter how much governments try and clamp, or not even necessarily clamp down, but try and regulate in some way, it's still to some degree the Wild West, isn't it?
I think the hitman profession must have been massively changed by the internet, but I never see much coverage of it, because traditionally you'd have your criminal syndicate and you'd have the scary man that you get rid of problems for you. But those people presumably are not strongly morally bound to that organisation. It's just kind of handy because they have the contacts there.
Yeah.
Whereas if they could say, I don't care who you get me to kill, it could be an absolute scumbag, or it could be a lovely like head of the bake sale. Like, if you pay me the money, I'll go do it. Then they'd be making a lot more money, and it would probably be harder to track them because there'd be no connection between murderer and victim. So I don't know if this is already happening, or if I've just given a bad person who happens to listen to this podcast
a good idea.
A good idea. But
you never know what happens on the internet, do you? So.
Gotta watch out. So I mean, we've just got a few minutes left, so it might be an idea to bring some of these ideas together. So what were we sort of going to take away from this, do we think?
I guess there's the aspect of moral distance, which is obviously major, isn't there?
Yeah.
But then there's also, because you're confronted with it, in terms of drones at least, you're confronted with it on a video screen, aren't you? So there's that distant intimacy that we mentioned. But then, you know, that only seems to be in terms of quite bureaucratized violence done by governments and state military.
With video screens?
Yeah.
That might have been the case until a couple of weeks ago, but Christchurch sort of changed
that. Of course,
that
absolutely.
Now any Tom, Dick and Harry with horrible views and ill will can whack their Facebook Live up.
And I suppose if we think about...
And we're all Obama in the Situation Room.
Yeah, and I suppose if you think about people who vote for stuff on Twitter and then if we were then confronted with the video of it at Christchurch, then that would be, again, that kind of that distant intimacy, wouldn't it?
Mm.
So I suppose... In a way, it's whilst warfare can be depersonalised in terms of you're not physically co-located with whoever you're going to impart violence to, it's not necessarily dehumanised because there's still that human connection to...
Which in a weird sense might be for the best, because if war were less horrible, we might well get used to it.
I mean, we mentioned Black Mirror, and I suppose one of the things that always seems to happen in quite a lot of episodes of Black Mirror is that people are confronted with what they've done. And if people are confronted with what they've done and what the impacts of what they can do in terms of whether it's voting for something on Twitter or it's just something negative, then often they seem to stop doing it.
Mm.
It was like the difference between someone booting off on Twitter about how much they hate ethnic group Z, and then if they were in a room with a person from that ethnic group, they'd almost 9 times out of 10 clam up, probably be quite friendly.
I mean, it's almost like restorative justice, isn't it? Where you put the perpetrator in a room with a person you've used. They've sort of perpetrated against,
So in terms of because distance, making something right, but I mean,
yeah, because distance is a problem, isn't it? I mean, this is where we've got a problem with trolling as well, sort of online, because ultimately keyboard warriors
can say whatever they like. Lovely in person, but...
yeah, but they can say whatever they like because they don't believe the person ever ends a real human being, do they?
Yeah.
So there is a need to reinsert the human, I think, in warfare and in all our sort of digital lives.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about for a little while is about sort of universal credit, because it's meant to be this enormous kind of algorithmic system that decides whether or not you can have X amount of benefits or Y amount, but at the end of the day there's a person on the other end of it, and almost all of them are being shortchanged because the computer system isn't good enough to work out actually how much does this person need. So
but then that's a question of needs and wants, isn't it, and define need.
Well, yeah, but I mean, when you listen to the testimony of these people, it's
yeah, no, I agree. We've had these chats before. Yeah. We've had these chats before, but it's just difficult though, isn't it? Because there's always a sort of rationing process, I guess.
Well, yeah, but I suppose that's the discussion for another time.
Maybe it is, yeah. Cool, so I think that brings us to an end. Well, thank you very much, Ben.
Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit InTheZonePodcast.com.